The Ketchum Prize is the FINRA Foundation's highest honor. It's an award named after former FINRA CEO Rick Ketchum, and it's designed to recognize outstanding service and research to advance investor protection and financial capability in the U.S. On this episode, we talk to the 2019 recipient of this prize, Professor Olivia Mitchell, about her extraordinary research on pensions and retirement income and her efforts to advance financial literacy worldwide. Welcome to FINRA Unscripted from Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Caitlin Kiernan. I'm pleased to welcome to the show today the 2019 recipient of the Ketchum Prize, Olivia Mitchell. Olivia, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me here.
Well, first of all, congratulations on the Ketchum Prize. This is the FINRA Foundation's award that recognizes the work that you've done to advance investor protection and financial capability in the U.S. This is just the latest of a very long biography of accomplishments that we could spend the whole show going into. But just the very basics, Olivia, you're an economist and International Foundation of Employee Benefits Plan professor at the Wharton School at UPenn. So what is the general focus of your research?
Most of my research has really since the beginning focused on retirement security. In fact, when I just got out of graduate school, my department chair said, "You have to teach a course on pensions and employee benefits." I knew nothing about these, so I was about two pages ahead of the students, and the book was terribly dull and boring. And so I finally decided I can do some more interesting research in this area. So I started working on pensions, then I began trying to look at Social Security. One thing and another, here I am all these years later, having really investigated all sorts of different corners and aspects of the factors leading to retirement security.
So you've been involved in this area of research for a really long time. How has it changed since you were fresh out of grad school?
Well, when I first started, as soon as I got out of grad school, I was talking to all my professors and people I knew about what would be some interesting new topics to research. Because when you start out as an assistant professor, you're supposed to carve out an area that will be your own. And of all people, I talked to my mother, who is a very smart woman, and she said, "You know, you should really look at aging. The aging economy," and this was 40 years ago, "the aging economy is going to be a very hot topic." And I thought, by golly, she's right. And so I followed her suggestion, and here I am all these years later.
So moms are always right, after all?
Well, they're frequently very perspicacious and insightful, and in this case, it was helpful.
And at this point in time, we've got 10,000 people retiring every day in America. How big of an issue is retirement right now?
Retirement is changing in America because the old model of retirement used to be work, 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 drop out of work, leave work 100%, and then either go play golf or sit on the veranda in your rocking chair. And that was the model, sort of work full time and then retire full time. The baby boomer generation, of which I'm a member, has increasingly remade the definition of retirement. So many older people are not retiring at all. Many boomers want to do something different, change careers, start a business, do volunteer work, go part time. So I think that as we are growing up in an economy where longer aging and aging longer is a reality, we're going to have to rethink what we mean by retirement. And sitting at home for 30 or 40 years, if you retire at 50 or 60, is simply not financially viable anymore.
And so what have you been researching to look into this future state where you can't just sit on the couch for that long anymore?
Well, one of the topics that I've been very interested in is financial literacy. And this started back in 2004, where with Ana Maria Luzzardi, a previous winner of the Ketchum Prize, the two of us were looking at why people don't seem to make better preparations for retirement. So we started with our first survey on financial literacy. We had three simple questions. They had right and wrong answers. Nobody could dispute that. And we were astounded to find widespread lack of understanding. People people didn't understand interest rates, they didn't understand inflation, and they definitely didn't understand risk diversification. So with that, we started digging deeper. Now we've done the same survey in about 21 different countries. We find actually very similar results, widespread lack of understanding. And the problem is that when people don't understand simple interest or risk diversification, they're going to invest incorrectly, they're going to save too little probably, and more troubling, when they get to retirement, they're going to withdraw their assets too quickly and not realize they can run out. So this has then led to a big effort to try to encourage high school students to invest more in financial literacy. And in fact, some states now mandate financial literacy in high school. So this has been a long project. There's a lot left to do.
And is the impact of this issue with financial literacy becoming more important because we're shifting as a society away from pensions to 401ks, where the onus is more on the individual to save for retirement?
It's absolutely true that in the U.S., we've shifted away from traditional defined benefit pensions toward 401k or 403b plans, defined contribution plans. I see that as more democratic in the following sense. In the old days, the only people that had defined benefit pensions were typically in heavy manufacturing, unionized firms, and anybody that had an interrupted labor market career, took out time to have children or what have you, really never accumulated much in that type of a pension. So the 401k or 403b world is a lot more egalitarian in that people can take their money with them and roll them over, or sometimes their retirement plans will allow portability between one company and another. So it's more likely that more people are going to be able to retire with some assets accumulated.
Well, that's a good thing to hear.
Right.
Another area that you've focused on in the past was Social Security. In 2001, you served as a commissioner for the President's Commission to Strengthen Social Security, a bipartisan group to restore Social Security solvency. Where are we today compared to 18 years ago when you were a part of that commission?
I wish I could be more positive about where we've gone with Social Security. But 18 years ago, when I served on the commission, bipartisan, 8 Democrats, 8 Republicans, we came up with a really good plan, which was to try to bring the system back to solvency, since it was facing insolvency. In those days, we still had some time. That is, there was still a period of time where the revenues that were coming into Social Security were still higher than the benefits that were being paid out. That's no longer the case. That is, we're now in the red. And every year we go forward, we're more in the red. And in about 12 years or so, there simply won't be enough money coming into Social Security to pay for the full scheduled benefits. So we wasted 18 years. Now, I understand that our proposal came out in 2001. That was also the year of the Twin Towers disaster, 9/11, stock market crash, etc. And things didn't work out so that the president could really push the proposal. But what I would say is that we're in a situation where benefits will have to be cut by about one quarter for everyone, retirees, future retirees, in about 12 years, or payroll taxes will have to be increased by 60 to 80%, or a combination of both, if you will. I think that Social Security is the foundation for our nation's retirement security system. And without being too pessimistic, I really hope that our current presidential candidates and politicians take seriously the reality that we have to restore Social Security to some kind of solvency. Otherwise, it's impossible to plan.
Yeah, that does seem like it would complicate anyone nearing retirement or even in retirement or my generation planning for the future and how much to save on their own separately.
The answer, I think, will have to be that we will all have to save more and we will all have to work longer. There's no question about those conclusions. And the evidence seems to show that most people who are claiming their Social Security benefits early today at 62 or 63 could continue to work for another 2 or 3 years. They're not in such dire health that they can't. But so I think what we need to construct is a set of reforms that will be seen as incentivizing longer work and delayed claiming rather than punishing people, because that's not very politically appealing.
No, not at all. So talking about how long people are living, you've done a lot of work on longevity risk. Can you tell us what longevity risk is?
Longevity risk refers to the possibility that any one of us might live longer than we expect. So you can go on a retirement planner online and they'll say, what's your age? What's your sex? Boom, you have 17.8 years left. Well, of course, nobody knows for sure how long they're going to live. But the reality is that's a mean, that's an average. And 50% of the people live longer than the average. Of course, 50% don't. But when they tell you plan for another 17.9 years or whatever, depending on your age and sex, what they're really not raising is the serious risk that you might live to be 105 or 120. Indeed, sociologists and epidemiologists have said that the baby that will live to age 200 has already been born. Of course, this makes insurers and life insurers and so forth, you know, pension fund managers quite nervous. But so as we look ahead and try to do a good job planning for retirement, to my mind, one of the key pillars of that has to be figuring out as best as you can what you think your spending needs will be in retirement. So pay the rent, you know, buy gas for your car, buy your health care, et cetera. And then make sure that you have a lifetime income source. Could be a combination of Social Security, an insured annuity, so that you can cover those basic needs. And once you have that taken care of, then you can maybe invest a little bit riskier if you have any money left over. But if you don't have those basic needs covered, then you can well run out of your assets in retirement. And that's the aspect of longevity risk that I think we need to protect against.
And so how should policymakers think about addressing that?
One source of longevity protection that we already have is Social Security. So I come back to the point that we really need to fix Social Security so that people have their floor level of protection. On top of that, there's the opportunity for people to buy deferred or immediate life annuities, say around retirement age, to top up their lifetime income streams so that they can cover their basic necessities. Now, I would make the point, however, that people at the bottom of the wage distribution probably don't need annuities because Social Security is very redistributive and it pays a relatively high benefit to low-wage folks. And obviously, if you're at the top of the wealth distribution, you can take care of yourself.
Jeff Bezos won't need an annuity.
And so forth. Bill Gates won't either, probably. But most of us in the middle could well benefit from taking part of our nest eggs at retirement and buying lifetime income protection. One of my favorite ideas of the last couple of years is to encourage plan sponsors, employers, to put a deferred annuity into the plan menu. Now, a deferred annuity would be one where, say, at age 65, you would buy yourself income protection that would only start paying you at age 85. So you have 20 years before the benefit comes out. You might not live to 85. That's why they're so cheap. But if you do live to 85, then you could have a materially improved standard of living the rest of your life. And who knows, you might be the one that lives to 120. I think women should be especially focused on longevity risk, and that could be an option.
This gets a little into the psychology side of things, but how do we, as a society, work to convince people that this is a good option when it's easy to be like, oh, well, I won't be that person who lives past 85, so I don't need it?
One of the hardest things to do is to get people to think about their own mortality. That's why they call life insurance. It's really not. It's death insurance, but they couldn't sell it otherwise. Similarly, it's hard to get people to think about the possibility they might live a very long time. And so one of the things we need to do is to start educating folks about what the survival distribution looks like. What's the chances that, say, you and your spouse, one of you might live to be 95 or 100 years old? Those numbers are going up all the time, especially if you've been fortunate to be educated and have health insurance over your lifetime. And so education is part of it. Another part of it is to avoid what we call the break-even approach to thinking about spending in later life. Something like 65, 70% of financial advisors offer the following story. They say, well, you could take your Social Security benefits as early as 62, which is the earliest retirement age that's permitted, or you could wait till you're 67, let's say. And they say, do you realize if you don't take it at 62, you'd have to live 15 more years, I'm making up the numbers, for sure, to get the money back that you gave up by deferring claiming. And that's called the break-even approach. The problem with the break-even approach is that it ignores the insurance aspect of Social Security. If you live to be 120, they will keep paying you. And so what it focuses people on is the near term. And people say, gee, I don't know if I'm going to live another 17 or 14 years. And so they take the benefits early. This used to also be what Social Security suggested that the field agents use. They don't do it anymore. But since financial advisors are using it, I think it's the message that induces people to take their benefits too young. Indeed, if you wait from age 62 to 70 to claim your benefits, your Social Security benefits go up by 76% the rest of your life. And that's a better deal than you can get investing in the market.
That is pretty a significant increase there.
Right.
So for financial literacy, you've done a lot of research. And what have been your efforts to try to increase literacy across the board?
When we started working on financial literacy, the place we started was trying to define it, because you kind of know it when you see it, but there's still, you know, some reasonable differences of opinion about what's financially literate. So some people say, well, if you don't invest in the stock market, then you must be stupid. You must be making a mistake. Well, people like my mother, who grew up during the Depression, thought the stock market was evil. And that's her prerogative to feel that way. And it's not that she was foolish. It's that that generation lived through a very hard time. So I think what we started with then is defining financial literacy as questions that were really black and white. Like, if you have $100 and it's earning 2% in a bank account and you keep it there for 5 years, would you have more than 102, equal to 102, or less than 102? That's a really simple question, and half the people can't answer it. And if they can't answer that, then how are they going to understand taking out credit card debt or payday loans or student loans or all the other obligations that we take on that are really causing financial problems for our population?
Yeah, that sounds very similar to the FINRA Foundation's National Financial Capability Study. They have that same exact question. And then they also have that financial capability, but then they also look at investor literacy, which is then more of that stock market focus. So it makes sense that one is a building block for the other.
Absolutely. And so this actually fed into some work that I've done on the rising levels of debt as people near retirement in the U.S. changing over time. So we investigated people in the 1990s, early 1990s. Then we compared them with two later cohorts. And every single cohort is reaching retirement age with more debt. In the old days, when I grew up, they told you never take on a mortgage such that the payments exceed one quarter of your income. You had to put down a quarter down payment for your house. Nowadays, you can take out mortgages that are, you know, no money down, et cetera. We also had a rule. These are rules of thumb that did pretty well for many of us over the years. Pay back your mortgage before you retire. People don't do that anymore. So what it means is they're going into retirement with more debt. They're more susceptible to interest rate fluctuations, and more of their resources are going to be devoted to paying down that debt, leaving them with less resilience.
Was it mostly mortgage debt that increased, or was it like student loan debt for their children and other, or credit card debt?
So mortgage was an enormous factor looking at older people's changing economic situation. There was student debt as well. Some of it was for their children. Some of it was for themselves that they simply hadn't paid off years and years later. So student loans are definitely a big part of the problem.
Well, and that gets back to what you were talking about with how if you don't understand how interest works, you can't understand the benefits of paying down your debt and the long-term costs of carrying student debt for decades.
Well, and if you're not financially literate, you're more likely to take out expensive loans, to pay only the minimum on your credit card, to do all kinds of things, which we've tried to ingrain in our children, you know, don't do that. But it's very much still a concern.
In economics, you generally presume that humans act rationally. Does a lack of financial literacy prevent an individual's ability to act in that rational fashion?
What we found is that financial literacy enhances many different aspects of financial behavior. So in certain states, financial literacy is required as a high school graduating course. And Anna Maria Luzardi and I did some research where we looked at young adults in their 25 to 35 age range, and we knew which states they had lived in when they went to high school. So we could examine who had gotten the treatment, if you will, and who hadn't. And what we found is that in the states where people had been required to undertake financial literacy training, that those young people were more likely to plan and save for retirement. Now, obviously, they were in their 20s and early 30s, so they hadn't saved a lot yet, but this bodes well for their future. The other thing I would add is the effect was strongest when states spent above average on their high school teachers. In other words, the way I put it is that you can't just have the soccer coach or the football coach teaching you how to balance your checkbook, though that might not be a bad idea either, but you do have to put some resources into it, which is one reason I've actually been working a lot with the Wharton schools. We have a program called Knowledge at Wharton High School, and there are 400 syllabi listed, which anybody can download for free, on everything from accounting to finance, et cetera, to help start teaching the high school teachers to do a better job.
So the curriculum is there and they could just have to devote the time to it.
Yep. Download it and study it and maybe start an economics club or something like that.
We'll link to that in the show notes.
And so that would be great.
Our listeners can take it to the high schools in their community, hopefully.
Mm-hmm.
So just to switch gears real quick, you have a forthcoming paper on fintech and how it's reshaping retirement planning. What are the impacts you're seeing in that space?
We actually have a book that just came out on the impact of fintech on retirement planning. And what I found really interesting in putting together that book was that, of course, there are 1,000 flowers blooming. Everybody has an app for that. However, most of the apps that exist now focus on very important things like helping you smooth your consumption when your income goes up and down. If you work in the gig economy, for instance, maybe some months you have a lot of income and some months you don't. And so some of the apps help you do that or help you hit targets or help you bucket your objectives. And those are all really good. However, I found none that do a good job advising you on retirement. So they're mostly focused on, you know, millennials or people younger than age 50, even though some of them tell you they're going to help you do retirement planning and decumulation. They're not there yet. And partly it's because it's really complicated and it has to be very individualized. So, for example, if you own a home, then maybe you need to plan differently than if you rent. If you have a partner who has a government pension, let's say, which sounds very secure, then you may need to plan differently than if you don't. And so all that needs to be very carefully integrated, and it makes it that much more complicated. But I think we're just not there yet on the decumulation phase. And so that's where the opportunity lies.
And do you think that's somewhere we'll get eventually, as like machine learning and whatnot might be able to help make those types of complex apps work?
I think it's possible. Another thing I've been working on is to try to integrate in 401k plans, not only target date plans that help you get to retirement, but through retirement, so that without too much work and effort, a plan sponsor can help people who've left the company continue to manage their money in a sensible and cost-effective way.
So, question for you. You've been studying retirement for a while. Do you plan to retire?
I am not currently planning to retire. My husband asked me, he's a little bit older than I am, about 5 years ago, if he could retire. And his company had been kind of declining and so on. So he retired and became an ultra marathon runner. So that's his notion of retiring. I wake up every morning and I'm so excited about what I'm doing that I'm delighted to keep doing it.
Yes. If you, as long as you keep studying it, you help others with their retirement. That could be very fulfilling. And then last question, I saw that on Twitter you are a scuba diver.
That's true.
How did you get into diving, and what's your favorite dive spot?
When we were little, my parents used to get National Geographic magazine, and they had the most beautiful color pictures of underwater scenes. That was one thing that always excited me. And then I grew up mostly in Latin America. We didn't have much TV, but we did have one black and white show called Seawolf. And you're too young to remember that, but that was Lloyd Bridges, who dove with these very antique outfits and so on. And it was just so thrilling. So I thought, when I started teaching, I was at Cornell University at the time, and they had very inexpensive classes. So I took the diving class. Unfortunately, the test was in a quarry, December 26th. It was freezing cold. There was snow on the land. And I said, I'm never going in cold water again. I would say my favorite dive spot has to be Galapagos. I remember vividly being down about 60 feet. We're hanging, you know, onto the rocks to be very quiet. And all of a sudden, about 500 hammerhead sharks started swarming all around us. They were not aggressive. They were not hungry. They just looked at us out of one side and then out of the other side of their heads. And I just thought, this is amazing. So I recommend Galapagos.
That sounds remarkable. Well, thank you, Olivia, so much for joining us. And congrats again on the 2019 Ketchum Prize. That's it for this episode of FINRA Unscripted. From Washington, I'm your host, Caitlin Kiernan. If you have any questions for future guests or ideas for future episodes, you can email us at finraunscripted@finra.org. Till next time.
Thank you.
Please note, FINRA podcasts are the sole property of FINRA, and the information provided is for informational and educational purposes only. The content of the podcast does not constitute any FINRA rule or amendment or interpretation to such rules. Compliance with any recommended conduct presented does not mean that a firm or person has complied with the full extent of their obligations under FINRA rules, the rules of any other SRO, or securities laws. This podcast is provided as is. FINRA and its affiliates are not responsible for any human or mechanical errors or omissions. Parties may not reproduce these podcasts in any form without the express written consent of FINRA.